This is On Target St. John's, a look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. What a beautiful fallish day, late summer day we're experiencing here in the metro region. Hope it's nice where you are and where you're listening from. It's not going to last, though. Those reports about Hurricane Larry are quite... concerning in many ways. Anyway, we're watching it very closely here at VOCM, and you can guarantee that we will give you everything you need to know about that storm and the changing situation related to that in the coming days. So do stay tuned. Well, in recent days, we've heard from both the FFAW and CNL about concerns over corporate concentration in the offshore and inshore fishing industries. DFO is currently conducting a review into foreign control in the fishery, while the provincial government has also committed to seeking feedback from those in the fishing industry and the general public to support what it calls a comprehensive review of foreign ownership in Newfoundland and Labrador's fishing sector. Well, here with the processing sector's take on the ongoing issue is the executive director of the Association of Seafood Producers, Derek Butler. Hello.
Hello, Linda.
So first of all, for the benefit of our listeners, tell us what the Association of Seafood Producers is and who makes up your membership.
So we're really a typical industry trade association. We work for the betterment of the industry generally for about 25 member companies of ASP in terms of influencing public policy, market access issues, CFIA issues, trade shows. And then unique really to the industry in the country, if not the world, we undertake the collective bargaining. And that's a large piece of what we do every year, and it's a bit like the old Bugs Bunny cartoon, Ralph and the fox and the sheepdog, or the wolf and the sheepdog. The FAW and ASP negotiate the prices for 10 to 12, 13 species per year. So we negotiate almost every week through the season. We don't get to go away every 3 years.
It is a lot of work. It's a lot of species, and a lot of work goes into setting those prices.
Absolutely. That's a big piece of the work. That's a big part of our summer.
So what has the last year been like for your members?
I would say it's been a good year, but not without its challenges. You know, the whole COVID, I said before, with COVID, there was no playbook for a global pandemic. We didn't know what would happen and how the year would play out with the restaurant trade, the food service trade so severely impacted, leaving just retail. We weren't sure what would happen. Just as there's no playbook for a pandemic, there was no playbook for year two of a pandemic or for post-pandemic. Assuming COVID hadn't gone on this year as it did, what would have happened with food service and retail demand for products, and how would it play out? Some product is predominantly food service or restaurant trade, some product is predominantly retail, and some is a mix. So it's been two challenging years. I'm looking forward to Christmas and putting some of this behind me.
Like us all. My understanding is, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is that a lot of the product that we catch here in Newfoundland and Labrador and process is shipped south of the border and is bound for restaurant tables. Is that correct?
That is correct. A large, 60-odd percent or more of our product goes to the United States. It's our largest market. More than any other province, we sell a fair bit. We sell more to Europe than other provinces might, just because of our proximity and historical ties to Europe. But we sell well over half of our product to the United States. Very, very important market.
So COVID had to have a pretty immediate impact.
A huge impact. And what transpired last year, which nobody could have predicted, when you look at snow crab, for example, the food service sector was on its knees. At retail, all the food that got eaten in the world, all the food that you ate, that I ate, that your listeners ate, came from retail, came from grocery stores because we weren't going to restaurants. So everybody who ate in an office cafeteria, ate on an airplane, ate on a cruise ship, ate in a casino, or ate in a restaurant, were now buying food at retail. So retail had huge demand just to get product in the coolers. And while it might surprise your listeners, people in the province, snow crab is already 50% goes out in retail. And so last year, it practically all had to go in retail. And it's not a white tablecloth environment when it does sell in a restaurant trade. So a lot of people would buy snow crab that you and I might be surprised in terms of income levels and disposable income. It's just a great, healthy product. It's pre-cooked, so it's ready to go once you thaw it. And that, again, allows people to access it more readily in a retail environment than having to take it home, thaw it, or cook it fresh and figure out what to do with it. It's a bit unique. And so that led to the increase in demand, which was just phenomenal.
So that shift now, I mean, you've got your customers waiting for you on the other side of the, and your supply chains and all of that sort of thing. So all of that had to change, I guess, overnight. And you had to reestablish things or I guess, develop new customer bases.
Absolutely. Everything changed. So we had to access the customers we had. We had to push more volume through the sector, through the trade, through the retail sector. And we had to reformat our packaging because it wasn't going to go out in a 30-pound box. You and I aren't going to buy a 30-pound box as a crab, which would be the typical sales format. So a lot of work had to get done very quickly last year. And it continued this year, although we did see food service recover as well. And the demand was still there, as your listeners know. I mean, crab is still selling very well now. The fishery's over here practically. But the fishery went very well, and the market was very strong this year.
Did those changes come with an added cost?
They did. There was a lot of added costs in the plant. So we did a lot of work last year. So this was my March, mid-March until the start of the fishery on May 11th. This was my bread and butter, who was to sit here in the office with the work of them, with the cooperation of the members and my colleagues here in the office, and working with occupational health and safety, working with the office of the chief medical officer to figure out what we needed to do to keep our plant safe, sharing information between ASP members and with non-members included, sharing as much information as we could with Canadian manufacturers and exporters and other producers in the province and across the country and in Europe about best practices to keep our workplaces safe, to keep our workers safe, to learn how we operate. It slowed down our throughput, so that had an impact. It increased cost, obviously. A lot of money went out the door to buy plexiglass and masks and whatnot and sanitizers. And a lot of that's not going to go away anytime soon, I think.
So have you found a comfortable place there now? I mean, I know in the beginning when we were talking about resuming the fishery after COVID struck, there were a lot of people really worried about how that was going to go. And some plant workers saying, you know, I'm not comfortable going in. Have you been able to find that happy medium?
I think we have. And I think people were rightly worried. It was all new. It was all brand new. So people were rightly worried, including our plant workers. And what we found was as we adopted these new protocols and procedures and brought in the safety equipment and the PPE, the personal protective equipment, and then plants would bring in workers and say, okay, here's what we're planning on doing. Let me walk you through how this is going to work. And as we did this, before we actually started to cut fish, we saw the levels of comfort increase and people began to appreciate what we were doing and how we were going to work to keep people safe. And then we ran our businesses. We ran all of last year. It's interesting, Linda, in the context of a global pandemic that impacted so many businesses, apart from retail and lumber probably and maybe the liquor stores, we ran our businesses. We produced the fish that was caught and landed, and we did it again this year. Newfoundland Labrador's seafood industry ran full steam, and I think it's kudos to both the harvesters and to the processors in the province that we were able to do this when so many other business sectors were impacted negatively. We made our typical contribution to GDP and then some because the market outperformed in a number of species.
Did you get much in the way of government support to keep things moving along? Because after all, I mean, the seafood industry, that's food, that's essential.
So we did. We had incredible support both provincially from then Minister Jerry Byrne at the time and from the minister this year. We had incredible supports from the federal level in terms of financial supports and cooperation to communicate messaging, to share information. I don't think it covers all the costs, but we had great support. I had nothing to say about that. It had nothing remiss to say about that. It was all wonderful. There was a recognition that it was an essential service, just as we might say, well, you know, snow crab is not essential to us. It is to our businesses, but it is to consumers who buy food, just as bananas are crucial to us. People produce bananas, and we were buying them all through COVID. And I make that comparison for those who were saying last year, well, it's not an essential food. This is crazy to call it essential service. Any food product is an essential service, and that's the way the government has to work. You can't go into grocery stores and start identifying the products that people are allowed to make and not make in a COVID environment. So we were allowed to operate. We had the supports to operate. We were designated essential service, and we ran our businesses, and it's a success story we don't talk enough about, perhaps.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of the Association of Seafood Producers, Derek Butler. We'll be back right after this.
Join Brian Medore weekdays at noon for a comprehensive update on news from every corner on all levels, newsmakers, weather, and more. Join us on your VOCM at noon.
And my guest today on Target is the Executive Director of the Association of Seafood Producers, Derek Butler. And we've been talking a little bit generally about the Association of Seafood Producers and how they've had to navigate the last 2 years now. But the reason why Derek is on this show has been surrounding this conversation about corporate concentration in the fishing industry and concerns about foreign investment in the fishing industry. And Derek, was the Royal Greenland deal announced earlier in the year part of what's led to some of those concerns being expressed?
I think so, and I think it was when they simply came into the province that there was resistance on the part of some, and I think some are using it, if people can make assumptions about who I'm referring to, just to beat the industry with and to suggest that something is remiss. You know, we've had some of the highest raw material pricing in history in recent years since that company has been in the province. The special panel on corporate concentration in 2001, I believe it was, talked about the benefits of, you know, foreigners coming into the business, making investments in Newfoundland and Labrador, bringing new perspectives, bringing new monies. It's a vote of confidence in the industry that people would be here and want to invest. And that company in particular has been here for a number of years in Jackson's Arm, First and Shrimp. So I think people are using it a bit as a curmudgeon or whatever the expression is. I don't think it's anything that people in the industry are worried about. If Newfoundland companies were in Denmark or elsewhere buying companies, we'd be proud. So I think it's a good thing.
So what does exactly this Royal Greenland deal with Quinlan's mean?
I don't know what the particulars of the deal are. I mean, it was announced that the deal was approved, and I think Quinlan's have made public comments about the fact that they continue to operate alongside Quincy / Royal Greenland. It means substantial investments, as all of my members have made substantial investments in rural Newfoundland and Labrador, and that's what it takes, you know, strong companies, financially sound, who can make the kinds of investments we've made. About $150 million in the past 5 years invested in rural Newfoundland and Labrador. And that panel that I mentioned, the panel on corporate concentration, addressed that and said you need a strong fishing sector to make those. You need financial strength and the entrepreneurial skills that go with that to make those kind of investments that companies have made. An industry built around marginal and undercapitalized firms, the report said, won't have that capacity and didn't have that capacity to shape a dynamic and an internationally competitive industry. And remember, Linda, we have to sell internationally. If Newfoundlanders ate only seafood and just take two of our top species, shrimp and crab, every meal, three meals a day, it would be, you know, a percentage point or less of the supply. We have to sell internationally. We've been a trading business since we first came here to catch fish. So, you know, you need strong, viable companies to make the investments we've made. $150 million, as I say, in the past 5 years. If you look at Royal Greenland, Quincy, St. Anthony, the lobster facility, New Harbor, Southern Harbor, you know, substantial investments. The FAW complained for a number of years about the Friday night frenzies, about weak and marginalized companies dropping product in the market on Friday nights to produce cash flow to buy again on the wharf on Monday. Well, now we've gotten away from that, and now they're complaining again. It's a bit like Goldilocks, right? Too hot, too cold. When are they happy? So I think we have a model now that has a number of companies that are strong, that are capable of operating and competing internationally. I think that's a good thing for the province.
But the whole idea of corporate concentration in particular, foreign investment in the fisheries, something that's always being reviewed. Are we talking about, you know, is there a concern over the percentage by which? Because I think a lot of Newfoundlanders and Labradorians would be very surprised to learn, let's say, if they woke up tomorrow to find out that the entire offshore is currently owned by a country outside of Canada.
They would be, and that's regulated by the federal government, maximum 49% ownership. In offshore fisheries, I'm on the inshore side of the business, and Royal Greenland's the only company that I know of, and the province has announced that they are going to do that review, and they've done it before, as I mentioned in that special panel report in 2001. But when you look at corporate concentration, for example, which is part of this, you know, two sides of the same coin perhaps, in 2010 we had 34 snow crab processing plants, and in 2020 we had 22. yet the quota was down more than the percentage reduction in plants. The quota was down 48% versus a 35% reduction in plants. Shrimp is another good example. So the quota was 177 million pounds of shrimp in 2010. And this year it's 24 million pounds. And we've gone from 13 or 14 shrimp plants to 5. So the level of quota reduction vastly outweighs the level of plant reduction. So I don't, there's actually less competition in terms of the amount of resource available per plant. Where there has been more consolidation that's not talked about is on the harvesting side. The number of active harvesting enterprises has reduced by about 48%, which means the larger boats are representing more and more of the value in the business vis-a-vis the smaller boats and vis-a-vis the plants.
So how are we doing in terms of our production capacity here in Newfoundland and Labrador compared to just a few years ago?
So I think we're still in a very strong position. You know, we've got 5 shrimp plants I just referenced that could do tens of millions of pounds of product. I mean, 10 million pounds per plant would be ideal. And we've got a quota of 24 million pounds. So more than enough capacity to deal with it. The challenge in introducing new capacity, well, there's 2 challenges, I think. One is, it says to every plant worker in Newfoundland and Labrador, you had too many hours last year. We're going to introduce more processing capacity and reduce your hours. I think that's wrong. That's the wrong way to go. And it makes it difficult to attract new workers, which is another issue, our labor challenges. But the second part to that is, if you reduce or add to the number of plants, you're compressing the season even further. So a number of years ago, the common statistic or line was, we had enough crab processing capacity to do 5 times the world snow crab quota. And I think the number still holds. It's probably even truer. The challenge is, we're compressing the seasons more and more, fishing starting in the beginning of April and finishing up in September, October. Crab finishes well before that. Shrimp finishes about then. So, you know, we can compress our seasons more and more, fish on the good days, and then have very, very abbreviated seasons. That's a challenge in the marketplace. If you're in the food service sector and you're preparing a restaurant menu in New York City, you want to know you've got product through the year. You don't need to know you've got it for a couple of months or 3 months. And if you're a worker, you need hours, not just to qualify for EI, and there is a heavy EI reliance, which is inevitable perhaps in the industry, but you need more hours to attract workers. You need to give people a better wage.
So where does some of this crunch lie? You mentioned a 48% drop in the number of harvesters.
Right, in the number of enterprises. That's part of the challenge. That compresses the season because you've got, or that actually would lengthen the season a little bit. But, you know, it's a challenge. It changes the power dynamic as well because you've got fewer boats controlling more resource as well. That all brings it back to collective bargaining. And it's been implied in this model that with fewer companies, we somehow are doing something untoward vis-a-vis prices for raw material. But that ignores a fundamental reality that my members face and harvesters are aware of. Prices are negotiated in a collective bargaining model. Academically, and I'm not proposing this would be the solution, it wouldn't matter if there was 5 companies across the table from the FAW, and there's only 1 union, by the way, or if there was 30 companies across the table. The prices are still negotiated in that format. So corporate concentration has no impact on raw material pricing. And we've seen that in the past 5 years when we've had some of the highest prices ever with this alleged concentration taking place. Some of the highest prices we've ever had for raw material.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of the Association of Seafood Producers, Derek Butler. We'll be back right after this.
Weekday mornings from 5:30 to 9. Jumpstart your day with Jerry Lynn Mackey and Ben Murphy. Newsmakers, traffic, weather, and more during your VOCM morning show.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of the Association of Seafood Producers, Derek Butler. And we've been talking a little bit about some of the concerns that have been recently raised by both the FFAW and CNL about their concerns about foreign investment and corporate concentration in the Newfoundland and Labrador fishery. And Derek, you mentioned a little bit earlier that prices have been relatively good. Is that true across all species?
It's not true across all species. Shrimp has had its challenges, and it's had its challenges for a number of years that really predate the COVID experience. We ended up, if you can believe it, last spring with inventory, so 2020 spring, with still had inventory from 2018. So that's a long time. And by the time we got to June or late June, that inventory was just 2019 inventory. The 2018 stuff was gone. But we've had challenges. The pricing has really been divorced from the market, and that's been a particular challenge in shrimp for the shrimp producers. On species like crab, it's been phenomenal. Now, there are some who would say, well, you know, we need to revisit the collective bargaining model. Something is amiss, something is wrong, and harvesters have been disadvantaged by lack of access for a second reconsideration, a second opportunity to change the price. Or actually, it would be a third, because you have the first go-around, then a reconsideration per side, and now they seek a third. And the challenge has been, I think, and we'd welcome looking into how we do collective bargaining. If you look at the quota last year of 64 million pounds versus the quota this year of 84 million pounds, it might have been 62 last year, that represents on raw material prices an additional $400 million in returns to the harvesting sector, up from $224 million last year at $350 a pound to about $630 million this year. And I did the math on $750. So I'm making some assumptions because the price was initially 5-plus and then went to 7-plus. The market returns this year on snow crab will be phenomenal. There'll be an increase of $459 million. Again, making a couple of assumptions on what all of it will sell for and what it all sold for last year and on the exchange rate for the year. So that's $459 million additional market value, but $400 of that goes to harvesters for the additional price paid on raw material. So for the plants, there's $59 million additional income this year for 20 or 30 plants. And just think about all the cost of running plants and fuel and packaging costs are through the roof. Shipping containers are gone from $2,000 a container to $10. Crazy numbers. And yet $400 million of additional returns in the harvesting sector. And it is plausible to say that on last year's numbers, the business was better than a break-even business. Harvesters made money last year. Now, there are fleet sectors where that might be a challenge with small quotas. So $400 million of additional income over and above last year in the harvesting sector, and yet now people say, well, we need to have another reconsideration. I guess they want the additional $59 million so that producers make no additional money when the market performs better, but it all gets transferred to harvesters. I think that's wrong. I think the collective bargaining model is fundamentally broken if my members are to be expected to pass on all the additional market increase, and this represents 80-20%. I think that's wrong. Why can't it be shared more evenly?
What sort of factors affect price negotiations, and have some of those factors changed because of COVID?
The issues are basically demand based on the market reports and a number of indexes from Urner Barry, an online site in the U.S., Undercurrent, out of Europe. There's market reports that the province contracts, and those are the basis for which we negotiate. And then the parties bring various trade media and their own perspectives and analysis on what the trade media is saying the market will be. Here's the crux of what we're trying to do, which makes it so very difficult, and we do it on every species all summer long. The market, we're trying to price product while it's still swimming in the water. And yet it's being alleged we're not being transparent and telling people something that we know. So we sit down in April, the crab fishery is probably not even announced to be open yet, and we're going to put a price on that raw material. And we do that for every species. There are no contracts, there's no sales, the fish is still in the water, and yet in this collective bargaining model, we're going to put a price on that, assuming the market will perform at a certain level. And it might not. It might be more, and it might be less. So each side gets one chance to go back in season, and it's a very short period of time, and seek a new price. We've had it all. We had models where it was one price for the season. We've had models where, in my years in the business, the price for crab, for example, was changed every 2 weeks based on the market. The union said that wasn't good enough. They wanted a seasonal price. Now they want a price that changes up to 6 times. Because if it gets set once, well, it would be 5 times. So every 3 or 4 weeks, you change the price again. You know, it's the Goldilocks story, right? Never quite happy. So the factors are what the demand is based on the analysis from the market reports and the trade media. And then the two parties bring their perspectives to bear. And the arbitration panel has to pick one of the two positions. COVID has impacted it, but differently. As I said, some species, which would predominantly sell in the food service sector, would have their market challenges because they didn't have a food service sector. Other stuff could go through retail, and that saw more demand.
Has that demand shifted or changed because of COVID? I mean, certain species, that sort of thing?
I don't know if it's changed by species, except for the product form. So, for example, snow crab, as I said earlier, which is cooked and frozen, so it's ready to go. That's unique because there's always been this consumer resistance. This is well studied. We talk about it at the various seafood shows, where consumers have a reluctance sometimes to buy fresh fish or chilled and then take it home and figure out what to do with it. Whereas other proteins can be more predictable. When you cook it, you get the same thing each time. Salmon's kind of in that category. But snow crab is pre-cooked, so all you have to do is thaw it and eat it. So that led to the increased demand for that product. The other thing that we probably didn't predict, and it's a good thing, is in a COVID era, there was heightened sensitivities around healthy protein, healthy foods. And that, I think, was part of the driver for seafood as well.
Of course, a lot of people now are much more informed and very interested in sustainable fishing practices and the like. You and I have talked about product tracing. How open is the industry to product tracing, and how can it be achieved?
Well, that's a great question, and one of the things I'm proudest of, and it's no panacea for all that ails us, but one of the things I'm proudest of is Newfoundland Labrador and ASP and my members. We certified the first fishery in Canada to the Marine Stewardship Council certification standard, which is a UK-based standard, and it was developed by Unilever and WWF, get this, in response to the groundfish collapse that took place here in 1992. And the marketplace was wondering, and different actors, is there a way to leverage market pressures and market forces to influence fisheries policy in a better way? And in response to that, we certified MSC shrimp to the MSC standard in 2007, and we've done snow crab, and my members have done a number of other species. So sustainability is paramount. And there are those who would resist third-party certifications, external certifications. But I put it this way. It's the prerogative of the consumer, whether it's you or me or anyone else listening or somebody in the Europe, to say, can I be assured that that product is sustainable? And I don't just want the attestation of your management authorities. I want third-party independent certification. And we see this, Linda, on everything. You can hold up a piece of paper and see a water print in the paper for sustainability and wood that's been recycled into paper that's been recycled again. So we all have the right to that independent third-party certification, and we've risen to those challenges for snow crab, for shrimp, and for a number of other species. And we're also doing work around fisheries improvement to raise the bar in terms of management and science and understanding for cod, for lobster, for other products, for eventual certifications, whether to the MSC standard or to some other standards.
My guest today on Target is the Executive Director of the Association of Seafood Producers, Derek Butler. We'll be back right after this.
Every Saturday is perfect for a night at the cabin. The Cabin Party with Brian O'Connell. Saturday night starting at 7 p.m. on VOCM.
My guest today is the Executive Director of the Association of Seafood Producers in Newfoundland and Labrador, Derek Butler. And Derek, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about quotas, because that's always a issue that comes to the fore every year. And we usually have these stock assessment panels and that sort of thing. Do you often make representation at some of those panels and you know, stay on top of the stock assessments?
I do. So that's my work from January until March or so, I guess, before we get into the business of negotiating prices. So I attend those meetings and participate in the various advisories, certainly, and some of the assessments as well, and provide my perspectives on the science and where I think things are going.
We saw, of course, recently 3PS cod in particular has been especially hard hit. The quotas have taken a big cut there. How have harvesters and processors had to adjust to that, and is it affecting employment levels?
It's certainly going to affect employment levels. It's going to affect incomes. That was one where the FAW and ASP were on the same page, and we were, to be frank, disappointed, and that's no surprise if the federal authorities are listening. We were disappointed in the decision. The science did show growth. And it would have supported, I think, a higher TAC or quota, total allowable catch, in that fishery than was decided upon. It's the minister's full discretion to make those decisions, and that's one thing we've asked to be addressed in the past. The unique, perhaps in the world, but certainly in the Western Hemisphere, the Canadian minister benefits from a clause, I think it's Section 7 in the Act, that gives him or her complete discretion in the Act. It's one of the most powerful cabinet portfolios you can get in Ottawa. And we'd like to see more sets of rails around those decisions in terms of how decisions get made, as opposed to complete discretion. And that includes the northern shrimp. You know, we're in the critical zone in northern shrimp. It's still an eminently sustainable fishery, and that's been confirmed by MSC. And our concern was this year that they didn't make the quota increase that I think the science could have supported on the math because of being in the critical zone. But there was room for a larger increase than we were given. And I would say, Linda, I would add, you know, one of the things that I've tried to push federally with both of the major political parties, certainly, the two major political parties, is here we are 21 years into the 21st century. I thought it would have been, and this was in the last election, and I guess there's still time to adopt it in this election, a chance for the parties to offer Canadians, particularly Atlantic Canadians and Arctic and BC Pacific fisheries, a renewed vision for Canadian fishery science. So here we are in 2021. It's not too late to have something on the table in respect of the parties' positions to bring Canada to the fore again for the best fishery science possible. We saw that. You, no doubt, VOCM covered the news on Capelet, where parts of the survey were missed. We're not able to explore in all the areas where we know there's capelin abundance. And sadly, that influences the decisions on capelin quota. And this has bottom-line impact on people's lives, you know, both harvesters, plant workers, and the plants in the communities.
So ask your candidates when they come to the door.
Absolutely. Let's get the best fishery science. And it would maybe take a large colloquium or forum where Canada invites the best and the brightest and says, what is it? What's the level of investment required? Perhaps with the same dollars, what more can we do to put innovation into the current fleet that we have on the water to gather information and to get the best science possible so we make the best decisions in respect to the resource. I mean, Mother Nature gives us a basket to fish from. Let's do it right. But let's ensure we don't lose economic opportunity in that process.
So on the issue of fishery science, because I know there's a lot of people who expressed serious concerns about it, what's your position on the potential impact of seals on stocks?
So there is a panel appointed to look at that. I mean, it has to be that seals are having some impact. Now, my members aren't in the sealing business. We're in the fishery business. But if we care, and that would include all stakeholders and ENGOs and others, if we care about overall sustainability in our oceans, then we have to care about the level of seal biomass and what the impacts of that biomass have to be on fish resource. And it's either there is an impact or there's not an impact or we can't know. But one thing is certain. I don't think that, with all due respect to those involved in the business or the science, I don't guess we've communicated well enough to people in the business, in the province, in the fishery. If the impact is not there, that needs to come out. So there is a federally appointed review panel, I believe. I think it's chaired by Glenn Blackwood, formerly of the Marine Institute, or currently of the Marine Institute, the Happy Retirement Glenn, that's pending. And I look forward to what that panel is going to report back on.
You mentioned capelin earlier, and I know that's a very contentious topic. Capelin are a species on which the marine ecosystem relies. Some people feel there's too much capelin being scooped up before they're able to come in on the beaches and spawn for the next year. But by all accounts, it looks like this past year was a pretty good year for capelin. So where do you stand on the capelin fishery, and do you think there's enough room there for greater quotas, or should we be slacking back?
I think there's room for certainly existing quotas, if not greater quotas, and I sleep very easy on that premise, and I've had the conversations with various representatives of the ENGO community. It was one of the first calls I made when I came to ASP in 2004, 2005. Should we be catching capelin if we're waiting for groundfish recovery? And the fact of the matter is the level of exploitation is so low in relation to the biomass and what other predators, seals and seabirds, whales and seabirds and other predators would take. that we're having no impact on the resource overall. I believe in the precautionary approach in the absence of sufficient information we should take the precautionary decision. But I also believe that the impact of the fishery is minimal. If you look at the quota of what we catch, 50% of which is female, and do the math based on the science of what proportion of the female spawning stock makes it back into the water to contribute to the next year's stock, we're talking 2,000 or 3,000 tons of fish. And if somebody thinks 2,000 or 3,000 tons of female population that would make it back into the population, the biomass to contribute next year and in subsequent years, is driving the stock dynamic, then the problem is greater than we can imagine. Now, people will say, and people have said to me, but it's the only thing we can do. We can't tell whales to eat less. We can't tell seabirds to do less. Well, that's the mantra of those who say we must do something. But that's not a good fisheries management program. We must do something is not really a good science, good response to any circumstance. Sometimes you don't do something. And certainly, stopping the fishery for the sake of a few thousand tons or less of female spawning stock, which would make it back into the population, that's not going to drive the stock dynamic, and it's not worth doing. The issue would be greater. But as you just said, we've had a great year in Capelin. I don't think the issue is what people think. Let's get the science on the table to confirm it.
And that seems to be, where DFO, really, that's the only thing over which they have control is over setting quotas and how many, members of a certain species are taken. So how do we square that circle, so to speak? Does it lie completely in better science?
Well, it lies in better science, and there was on offer a number of years ago, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, an additional acoustic survey on Capelin. I don't think we've had that yet, so we've called for that, and that might go back to my call for a renewed vision for Canadian fisheries and ocean science for the 21st century. But to go back to what I just said a little bit earlier, to say we just should do something and stop the fishery because that's all we can do, it's kind of cutting off our noses despite our faces. If it's not going to affect the outcome in any regard, then it's not the right management response in terms of the resource.
Derek Butler, we've been talking a lot about the fishery on this show. It's still one of the biggest industries in Newfoundland and Labrador. We often tend to forget about that as we move towards other things. But some final thoughts on the industry and how it can improve.
So one of the challenges is labor. We've got to address labor, and it's going to be harder and harder to attract people with the population decline we see coming. So that needs to be addressed at the federal level and at the provincial level. And I know we've already started those conversations, and people are receptive. One of the joys, you just said, it's an important resource. It's the ongoing mega project, and what an honor to be working in it, to be working with the people, both harvesters and processors, stakeholders, government at both levels. It's the ongoing mega project that year after year contributes $1 billion plus to GDP, 15,000 livelihoods in our province alone. I think it's 95,000 in the country. And as Mr. Etchegary said, I think earlier on your station today, the multiplier effect on that, you're affecting tens of thousands of lives. So year in and year out, we're here. We buy lots of quality seafood from the members. And Linda, I'll add one additional thought that listeners might be surprised to hear. The relationships are mostly positive. I meet harvesters at the mall or on my travels around the province. Somebody recently bought me a meal in a restaurant, a harvester, paid the bill to my surprise as I was getting up to leave. The relationships are mostly positive, even though the public piece that people see is the institutional ASP versus FAW. But even within the FAW and ASP, I think there's begrudging respect. It's difficult work. We negotiate almost every week, wake up Monday and start over. But it's a dynamic, important business, quality, high-level protein for the world. And it's a great honor to work in it, and the people are what make it special.
Derek Butler, I do appreciate your time this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda.
Derek Butler of the Association of Seafood Producers with his members' take on the Newfoundland and Labrador fishery represents quite a bit of money here in Newfoundland and Labrador, still does to this very day. And in fact, last couple of years, we've recorded some of the highest levels of income out of the fishery than we have ever before. So an important topic for certain. We'll be back tomorrow. I do hope you're able to join us then. In the meantime, time. Back to school, everybody. I'm very eager to hear my son's take on his first day of school last year. He got a little email beforehand, so he knew who his teacher was going to be, and then we had a sense of who his classmates were going to be. But this was different. This year was back to so-called normal when he finds out, when he walks into the school and sees his name outside the classroom. So I'm looking forward to hearing all the news from my little fella later on today. I'm sure he's going to be full of it, as will your youngsters and or grandchildren if you have kids in the school system currently. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye for now.